Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. I'm John Noonan of Azure Marketing, and I'm excited to have Forrester Research Vice President and Principal Analyst James Staden joining us to discuss not only why, but also how firms are adopting the cloud. Before we get started, just want to direct your attention to a few items. You'll see a resource list at the bottom of your window, so you'll be able to find the slides from today's presentation there, among some other good resources. Also, we'd really appreciate your feedback around the session today, as well as any future topics you'd like us to cover. So please be sure to answer the poll questions towards the bottom as well. And lastly, if you have any questions along the way, please submit those via the Q&A chat widget, and we'll answer as many as we can towards the end of the webinar. And with that, I'll hand it over to James.
Great. Thanks so much, and thanks, everyone, for joining us here today. Obviously, we're several years into cloud computing, so there's no point in talking about what it is. What's more important is what enterprises are actually doing with it. And what we see very much in true adoption of cloud platforms is a continuing pattern we've seen from the beginning of the market, which is a pattern of adoption being driven primarily by developers and not being developed for cost savings, as oftentimes shows up in the press, but for agility. The main reason we see developers using these cloud platforms is to build out typically new services and get them to market quickly, which is why we see a preponderance of applications in the mobile space, Internet of Things, applications that are building and using predictive analytics, and things that are designed to present greater engagement with clients, a big topic that Forrester has been talking about for the past couple of years in the age of the customer. What we also see here is that when we talk about developers leading, they're doing this on behalf of the business unit. So again, this is not driven by the CIO, driven by the IT department. It's typically driven by business agendas and business needs. And what we're doing in terms of the applications that we're building is we're changing models. We're moving to a modern app architecture, which is more composite, which means that applications are more composed of multiple services that work together to create the user experience, rather than being what we've thought of in the past as all the code in one single executable, or even the three-tier model that we saw in the web era. Modern applications have multiple tiers, multiple layers, and are designed so that you can advance individual services or capabilities without having to worry about compatibilities with other parts of the application or causing significant debug challenges as you try to advance the application. What we're also seeing in the applications that are being built in the cloud today is they're not being built 100% pure in the cloud. They're actually being built by bringing together elements that lie in the cloud, elements that lie in traditional hosting, or are being managed by a managed service provider. This is the hybrid reality we find ourselves in today. So don't think about you need to migrate all your applications to the cloud or that you need to build them entirely as cloud native. Think about the elements and services that you have today that make up the parts of the experience you're trying to create and build only the new things you need. And if you can build those new services and new capabilities by tapping into cloud capabilities that give you the ability to build them faster, more cost-effectively, more scalable, with greater geographic reach, that's the way to think about it. So don't think about build 100% new, migrate 100% old. Think hybrid. Think what works where you have it, and where can you get the best gains from building something new. That's very much what we're seeing happen in today's cloud applications. And you see this in our survey data as well. If you look at the developers who have experience using the cloud and the reasons that they are using the cloud, you see a preponderance of responses that are getting 20 to 25% of the response back from the surveys. Most commonly, you see statements like the first one, fastest way to get my project done, or the fourth one, make it easy for me to create applications, or the one below, well suited to the types of applications I'm doing. You also see some of the most popular languages pop up very high here as well, which shows that developers want to choose and use cloud platforms that empower the skills they already have and allow them to be productive as quickly as possible. Now, you'll also notice on here that the second item on the list is lower cost than on-premise environments. Those of you who are in the development world or have worked with developers realize that very rarely do developers themselves understand the total landed cost of deploying applications, whether it's in your hosted environment today or in your own data center. This is really more of a reflection of the ease in which to get access to the resources and the speed in which they can make them work. So lower cost to them is really more about productivity than anything else. Will you save money by putting applications in the cloud? If you put the right components in the cloud and you use them appropriately and optimize their use, absolutely. But don't fixate on cost as the primary reason. As you can see here, and as you'll see throughout this presentation, productivity, speed, customer reach, and scale are the big reasons to go to the cloud. Now, how quickly are developers who have experience in the cloud moving to the cloud? In this slide, I want you to pay attention to a couple things. Primarily, pay attention to the dark green. What we're showing here in this particular slide is a set of responses, again, from developers, saying what percent of their code that they have written overall is being deployed into the cloud. And the dark green corresponds to less than 20% of the code they've built going into the cloud. Notice how the dark green starts to decline as the years go forward. And as we look at the estimates going forward, it declines dramatically. The lighter shades of green start to expand a bit, and then the dark blue section, which corresponds to between 60 and 79% of their code going into the cloud, expands dramatically starting in 2016 and significantly more in 2018. What this shows is that developers are going to the cloud, having a positive experience, and wanting to do more of that. And that's what you can expect to see going forward in most enterprises. When we talk to enterprise IT development teams who have experience using the cloud platforms, the public cloud platforms in particular, this is the pattern that we see consistently. Now, when we talk about the kinds of workloads, I mentioned mobile, I mentioned Internet of Things. Here's a more exhaustive list, so you can see the kinds of applications being built. Note the second and third on the list here. App integrations, that points very much to the hybrid world we've been talking about here today. A lot of application components that go into the cloud connect to SaaS applications, connect back to the corporate headquarters, or connect over to traditional hosting offerings from other companies. That's a very common pattern that we see, which of course belies very much the statement that this is not about 100% pure cloud applications. If you notice the next one down, internal web business applications. While a lot of people think the public cloud is for consumer-facing things, it is not. It's being used heavily by enterprises to reach employees. It's also being used to reach business partners. It's being used for training videos. It's being used for a significant amount of enhancements to what we normally would have thought of as the intranet or applications you would build and host entirely within your own data center. So you can see a significant amount of application types going on here. I've highlighted app testing and QA because there's a belief out there that most of what's actually happening in the public cloud is just test and dev. As you can see here, not even. Only a third report that they're doing test and dev in the cloud. Now, obviously, the other kinds of applications had to go through a test and dev cycle, so we can assume that they were tested and dev'd in the cloud as well before going live. But the preponderance of other responses here show that the majority now of applications that get built in the cloud go into production on that same cloud environment, which might be a little bit scary if you're in the IT side of things, because IT views the cloud very differently. For the most part, the IT department, who of course has its own data center to operate and protect, has a significant amount of assets it's responsible for on-premise, oftentimes looks at the public cloud as an alternative, and in many cases, an alternative that could result in them losing their jobs. As a result, we end up seeing more of a focus of them saying what you see in the very first line here, we want to remain competitive as an IT organization, so we are going to offer private cloud. We are going to offer alternatives. They do recognize, though, however, that they need to have public as part of that portfolio, and that's very much why you see the rest of the responses on here reflecting that we see a circumstance in which the lower cost of ownership may be existing in the cloud. We see an opportunity to use it for disaster recovery or business continuity. We see an opportunity for us to have greater on-demand case scalability. A lot of the characteristics that we know to be true in the cloud from the development side are starting to filter over to the IT department, but they're still quite reluctant to use the public cloud to the full extent that the developers have realized it's good for. As a result, we're ending up in this circumstance in which hybrid is not a future state, but it is becoming the norm. as you can see from the responses on here, there's a variety of responses coming from organizations about how mixed they really are. But when we actually talk to them and we look at their portfolios, they're typically very mixed already, with a preponderance of SaaS applications, a multitude of applications that have cloud elements, and a multitude of cloud services that have been incorporated into their portfolio. As a result, we have to be thinking about new applications that we build from this point of view. What makes sense to be deployed where? How best should we integrate them together so that we can ensure the best customer experience possible? So let me give you an example of what that might look like. Here's a new class of application that we see quite a few companies doing. This one in particular happens to be an Internet of Things application that's designed around our fitness. In this particular case, the application will run on a phone, and so there is a mobile front-end application or iOS version of this application. And in this element, it will speak to the sensors inside the phone, foot pods if you have them in your shoes, collect a whole variety of information so that it can give you immediate information during your fitness workout as to how well you're doing. Now, all the information it's gathering could be done entirely in isolation and just simply tell you how you're doing and you're running. But today's fitness applications try to put a social element involved in here. You may be running on a course that your friend Susie ran yesterday, and you want to know how she did and how you're going to do in comparison to her. Well, you don't have Susie with you, so by taking advantage of the cloud, we can take all the sensor information that's coming out of this application, and we can move it up into a cloud data analysis where we can do some real-time business intelligence on how you're doing on this course compared to how Susie did yesterday on the same course, which allows us to come back to the user in the middle of the run and say, at this point in the run, Susie was ahead of you. Please pick up the pace, which is exactly what fitness people are looking for, is an immediate engagement and response from the application. Now, the reason we would use a public cloud in this circumstance is because we don't want to sell one copy of this mobile application. We want to sell millions of copies of this application, which means that we could have hundreds of thousands of people using this app out running at exactly the same time. And while the information coming off the GPS and the sensors and the other elements that the user has on them might be very small trickles of information, we don't really want hundreds of thousands of millisecond transactions coming into our corporate firewall. I don't know how many of you have a CISO would be thrilled with that, but I haven't really met one yet. So it makes a lot more sense to move all of that information up into the cloud, where we can scale up resources in the morning when everyone is running, do the real-time analysis, create the indices, respond back to them with what they need, and then when the period in which people have returned to work and there's not as many people running, we can scale that environment back down and manage it much more cost effectively. Now, we've gotten to the point where our runner here has now finished the run. They beat Susie, time to give her some social media feedback, and also we find out that the runner has now hit 300 miles in his shoes. He's done with those shoes. So now we want to open up an e-commerce connection with them so we can sell them a new pair of shoes. In this circumstance, we may want to talk to the e-commerce system as well as our inventory management system for the shoes we have in stock that are all back at the corporate headquarters. So we're going to set up a second connection, a secure connection, hopefully one that meets PCI compliance, so we can take their credit card information and fulfill that order. This is what a modern hybrid application looks like. It takes advantage of the services and the capabilities where they exist and where they're optimal to deliver the best user experience possible. So what does it mean in terms of a modern application? I showed you the breakout. The breakout that we've talked about here oftentimes is called omnichannel, where you have to support iOS, Android, Windows Phone, web devices. You might have to support certain tablet types as well, so you have to be thinking on the client in a very holistic fashion and try to give as native an experience as you can. You're going to deploy these applications on an Elastic mobile backend as a service and take advantage of Elastic services like the data analysis I talked about. You're then going to want to aggregate discrete services together rather than try to build them all into one big virtual machine or into one large code set. This makes scaling easier. It also allows you to take advantage of discrete services that might be advanced by other people. For example, you may be choosing to use Azure Machine Language, as an example, to do some of the algorithms around the analysis coming out of all the phones. Well, you could build your own BI solution. You could manage and maintain your own algorithms. or you could rely on a cloud provider to advance these things where they happen to be adding new capabilities almost every week. And they're going to make sure the service stays up, they're going to make sure it scales, and these are not concerns you have to worry about anymore. As such, you may be actually exposing some capabilities or services in your application as well, and you want other applications to take advantage of it, maybe within your own company, but maybe available to third parties as well, which means you need to expose those services in a way that they can be consumed easily by other applications. The best way to do this typically is to expose them as REST APIs, and it helps to use a managed API layer to manage and maintain these API interfaces for you. You're probably going to incorporate some open source software, so you may be taking advantage of .NET in one part of the application, Swift in another part of the application, and Linux on the back end. So you need to make sure you have a public cloud platform that allows you to support these different languages. And then, of course, you're most likely going to be advancing this application using DevOps techniques that allow you to advance the application in a continuous delivery model, where you're adding new features and capabilities as you're getting feedback from the customers and as you're looking to enhance new capabilities. And, of course, spending as much time as you can measuring all the feedback coming back from the users about your application so that you can continue to make it better. These are the core elements of modern applications, and you'll be run through this entire process as part of your new application lifecycle management. So where should you start? You could start from the perspective of build it new, or you could start from the perspective of moving things. Take things that are running in your data center or in traditional hosting and start by migrating a few of them over to the cloud. What do we recommend? Well, we wrote a report where we talked about application portfolios are going through a seismic shift, and that image of a seismic event, an earthquake, is an important analogy here to understand. If you're building applications that directly engage customers, particularly if you're engaging consumers or the employees inside your own company, they're going to be the most scrutinous of the user experience that you provide. They're going to be switching devices the fastest. They're going to be needing scale. They're going to be all over the world, particularly if you work for a large multinational company. If you're reaching out to consumers, the app stores are available worldwide, which means your application can be deployed anywhere in the world. So you're essentially in a need to advance your applications, modernize your applications as quickly as possible. So you feel very much on the fault line. Got to get into cloud. Got to get into DevOps. Got to get these new languages going. If you're in the back office, say you're the manager of the SAP environment, or you are a DBA on multiple SQL servers and so forth, you might be thinking, what earthquake? What problem? I'm not feeling this. Why am I having to deal with you guys? Why do you keep talking about DevOps and it doesn't seem to affect my world? These two mindsets are present in almost every enterprise we run into. And they, of course, show very, very different points of view when it comes to cloud. The way to really resolve this is to recognize that if we're going to build hybrid experiences and hybrid applications, we have to marry these two worlds. We have to allow those on the fault line to go as fast as possible, while we don't force the back office to try to move at that speed. Because, A, those systems typically can't move at that speed. They haven't been architected appropriately. We might be talking about huge amounts of data that would be painful to migrate. We may be talking about license terms that are just not suited to a cloud environment as well. So how do we go forward with this dichotomy? Well, the best way to look at it is to recognize that the shift that will happen in these classes of applications will happen at very different paces. If we think about systems of engagement, the kind of applications that are on the front line, we're going to completely revolutionize these, and we're going to do so within the next 5 years. For some of us, we're going to revolutionize it even faster than that, and we're going to take all these applications and move them from the historical three-tier, web-centric, browser-centric model that they're in today to the modern application architecture. It won't be 100% cloud, as I said. It'll be a mixture of cloud and traditional hosting, some things on-premise as well, but we'll absolutely move these applications to the modern architecture in this time frame. So you do want to focus your DevOps efforts on these front-end applications. But again, we're talking about the front-end, so we're not asking you to move the entire service or experience. The back-end, what we typically call systems of record, will go through a much longer transition. Many of our systems of record will not transition at all. Some of them we will replace with SaaS applications. Some of them we will hand to a managed service provider to run and operate for us in what's called an ASP model or application service provider model. But what we will do to shield the systems of record from the chaos going on in the systems of engagement is we'll put an integration layer between the two. And this integration layer, many of us have used service buses in the past for this. We've used ETL, we've used ODBC, a variety of other technologies to integrate these front-end and back-end systems. But increasingly, as I mentioned earlier on in the modern application discussion, we're going to want to have an interface that the systems of engagement can touch and integrate with very easily. And increasingly, that is REST APIs, which is why an API management layer starts to become critical here for shielding your systems of record from the chaos that happens in the systems of engagement. If you are not investing currently in an API management layer with four systems that continue to run in your data center that are your systems of record, this is an area that you should be investing in the next year for sure. The more you can expose your existing data sets, your existing applications to the front end in this fashion, the more you can shield them from the chaos that's caused by the transition and migration that takes place. Now, some legacy applications, you will want to make very cloud relevant. Just putting an API in front of them may or may not be suitable for their needs. We've seen this in multiple industries for quite some time, and so there's actually a pattern here that we can look at that explains how to move this forward. If you think about the old days before even the web, we had a lot of applications that were written entirely on the mainframe. They were posted there for a variety of good reasons, but when the web came about, having a simple green screen terminal as the means of getting access to this application just didn't work. So what did we do to make these legacy applications relevant in a web era? We didn't rewrite them. We didn't move them off the mainframe. What we did instead is we surrounded them with web infrastructure. We put a series of app servers and web servers around these applications, and we wrote green screen scraping technologies that allowed us to pull the information that would have been given to a green terminal and convert it into HTML. And this is what allowed us to connect the legacy applications into the modern world. Now, in this cloud era that we're in right now, we're actually seeing the same kind of pattern, where web and HTML are not necessarily the only part of the story here. We're now surrounding the legacy applications with API management layers, mobile backends as a service, SaaS integration layers, and SOA engagements that we've seen in the past. While SOA in the past meant SOAP interfaces, this time around it means REST interfaces for the most part, and that's the big change that we see. Now, if we just left the picture like this, and you were a CIO looking at this picture, you'd be saying, well, I spent hundreds of thousands on my legacy application. I know I spent another hundreds of thousands on my web infrastructure. Am I just going to put another hundreds of thousands on the web tier on the outside? That would be true if everything stayed static over time, but it doesn't. In fact, if we look at what happened in the mainframe era transitioning over to the web, we started to realize that we could migrate certain functions and capabilities off of the mainframe and directly into the app layer of the web infrastructure. For example, if you look at the travel industry, if you go to hotels.com, Orbitz, a variety of other services, the majority of the time when you are looking for the right hotel room, the right airline seat, and so forth, you're simply reading that information. You haven't actually bought anything yet. We don't need a mainframe to fulfill the read function. In fact, we can cache all that information off of the mainframe out into the web infrastructure and allow us to get access to that information much more readily. We may still want to have the mainframe to resolve the actual sale of the actual seat on the actual flight when someone actually books it. That's a much, much smaller amount of traffic. If you look at the travel industry, it's somewhere between 101 to 251, the amount of reads to the actual writes that occur in that industry. By lifting all of that read work off, we can shrink the mainframe footprint significantly so that it is only doing the functions that it's absolutely required to do. That is part of the modernization that we're seeing take place in the cloud era today. As we start to shift more of the functions, we can shift them to the web infrastructure, we can build them anew in the cloud layer, and as we do that, we achieve economies of scale in the outer layers that allow us to achieve the cost efficiencies we all as organizations are looking for. But again, we're not doing this first for cost savings. We're doing this first for agility and for engagement. And that needs to be concentrated in your mind as you build out your cloud strategy. Now, having said this, what should you do and how should you get started? Well, where to start first and foremost is, if you're not doing test and development in the cloud now, that is the safest and easiest way to get started. If you have an MSDN account, you probably aren't using your Azure credits. Start using them now to understand how that environment works, how you can use these tools. Visual Studio is fully compatible with this environment. Multiple languages, including Java and Python and others, work very well in the public cloud. So it doesn't matter what language you're coming from, what IDE you're coming from, you can start today to learn how to use these cloud environments. What kind of applications should you start with? Start with your systems of engagement. Building out and understanding how a mobile backend as a service can help you deliver a more rich, robust, and scalable solution for any mobile application you build is a great place to get started. And then also look at workloads that you have that get value from elasticity or transiency. Elasticity, of course, means that the application scales out horizontally as traffic goes up. So as we were talking about the fitness application before, something would scale up in the early morning when people are running, and you could easily scale it back down in the midday. Transient workloads are applications that don't have to be running all the time. So batch is a good example of this. End-of-year roll-up is a good example of this, as is disaster recovery and backup. Applications that are going to fire up some compute capacity, do some data processing, and then you can shut them down entirely. The reason these kinds of workloads are so well suited to public cloud platforms is because the public clouds are priced on a per-use basis, and there is no ongoing charge if you are not using the resource. So use that to your advantage. If you can turn the compute off entirely, if you can shut the VMs down entirely so they just sit in storage, your compute costs for that period of time are zero. And you want to constantly be getting back to zero. Test and dev will, of course, give you this advantage as well because test and dev itself is also very transient. Next, for the IT department, the first thing that IT department needs to focus on is recognize and realize the public cloud is not the enemy. The public cloud does not eliminate your need for a data center in the future. If you are a DBA, if you are a SAP administrator, whatever your role is inside the IT department, that role and that skill set is relevant in the cloud era. If you decide to move certain applications to the cloud, your skills will still be needed to manage and maintain those resources. The beauty is you will be able to shift your focus not to the day-to-day operational management of that workload, because the cloud takes care of that, but making sure that workload gives the greatest benefit to your organization. That's where you really want to be focusing. So make cloud a part of your portfolio. Recognize that some services are going to be best on-premise. Some are still going to be best in the cloud. Some are going to be good to replace with SaaS. You want to be open to all of it and have it all be part of your portfolio. Someone who's a great storage administrator or a great business continuity expert will now have a series of additional tools to continue to do their job well, even if they don't have the same resources as they did before. Next, a lot of the cloud services are going to come in, and there's opportunities for developers to set up their own accounts on these services. Try not to encourage that too much. The best thing you can do is to encourage centralized identity federation with these services so that they can come through you to get accounts on those cloud services. There's a variety of opportunities to do this. Best place to start is with identity federation, using the single sign-on capabilities available through the clouds as well as through on-premise Active Directory and LDAP systems. There's a variety of tools that will also ease integration of these cloud services into your main portfolio. System Center has good tools here. There's third-party heterogeneous management tools that do a good job of integrating. And, of course, there's monitoring tools that can monitor all of these services in a centralized point of view, similar to Splunk. All of these need to be managed and looked at, because the more you can make it easy for your developers to get into cloud services by going through the IT department, the more you and IT can manage and monitor those connections. to ensure that if you need a VPN for a certain amount of traffic, you know the VPN is in place, you know it was configured correctly, and if it wasn't, you know that you could take action. That's your best position to be in. If you keep your head in the sand, let the business units sign up for their own contracts with all these cloud services, you're just going to make more work for yourself later when more integration and more hybridization becomes the norm in your company. The next thing you can really focus on is a very important concept that we introduced several years back that is more true now than it was at the time that we mentioned it, which is the uneven handshake. What do we mean by the uneven handshake? Well, different than traditional hosting or managed service providings, when you go into the cloud, you're taking advantage of a set of standardized and automated and multi-tenant services that are deployed and managed exactly the same way for every single customer. This means that you don't have the opportunity to tell the cloud provider, please configure this service differently. Please set up security differently. Please do something different about it. Put it on a different server. Use a different hypervisor. You don't get those options. What you get instead is you get the service operated for you, scaled for you, managed and maintained for you. What you need to concentrate on is, can you work with the configuration they've been given to you, and what additional configuration options above what they provide to you are available to you? For example, on the topic of security, you may choose to use a cloud provider's virtual machine, virtual network, and virtual storage in which they provide encryption, but not the kind of encryption you want. Most public clouds give you the option to change the configuration of the security. You can add your own encryption agents on top. That's your part of the uneven handshake. Understand where the cloud provider stops, where is the end of the service they provide, and what options remain for you, and then take the responsibility to configure, manage, maintain, and monitor your side of the uneven handshake. Another place that this comes up all the time is around compliance. Many of the public cloud platforms out there carry compliance certifications for things like PCI or HIPAA, or if you're in the federal government space, for FedRAMP. What these certifications mean is that the cloud services, as designed and up to the line of abstraction, will meet these compliance standards. They do not cover your part of the uneven handshake. So if you're trying to achieve PCI compliance and you pick a PCI compliant cloud and a PCI compliant VM and then you leave port 80 open, you screwed up. It's not the cloud provider's fault, even though you were using a certified platform. Now, a lot of IT departments struggle with this uneven handshake, trying to understand it because these are often new environments with new configuration tools, management tools, and so forth. If you happen to choose some of the clouds that are more robust in the market, you'll find that a lot of the tools you're comfortable with, such as System Center, Splunk, RightScale, and others, work with these environments, will make this easier to do. But you're not 100% on your own. A growing trend in the market, which was just accelerated this week by DataPipe, is for managed service providers to take on the uneven handshake for you. So if you don't want or aren't comfortable that you will be able to achieve your objectives, you can bring in a managed service provider who will, as a sub-administrator on your account, take over these responsibilities for you, monitor, manage, and maintain. I mentioned DataPipe a few minutes ago. This is a U.S.-based managed service provider who announced this week that in addition to supporting Amazon Web Services managed services, they have now added Microsoft Azure as well. And this is a pattern we expect to see repeated by multiple managed service providers around the world. So, final recommendations. You really need to concentrate on who is the right cloud platform for you and for your needs. Best way to think about that is to look at your own investments. As I mentioned at the top, companies are going to their clouds because they are productive when they get there, which means you want to look at what are the skills of the developers you have building out your systems of engagement. What languages do they work in? What tools do they use? What IDE is their preferred? What skill sets do they have around the middleware? Do they understand how certain libraries work? Are they IIS developers? Are they ASP.NET developers? Are they LDAP developers? You really want to understand where their skill set lies, because the cloud they choose will either make them very productive or send them up a learning curve. And you don't want that learning curve when you're trying to get new capabilities to market fast. Second, don't look for that cloud to do absolutely everything you're looking for. Look for it to provide the things you want from the cloud. You're going to build applications in a hybrid fashion, which means don't look for the cloud to support your 1975 SAP ERP implementation. That's not going to happen. That would be dumb anyway if you did put it there. Instead, look at someone that provides a mobile backend as a service if that's important to you. Video streaming capabilities, if that's important to you. Has a wide variety of business intelligence and analytics capabilities, if that's important to you. Has data centers in the right geographic locations. Has the right certifications. Meets security and compliance rules. All of these things are more important. But again, remember, you are looking for the things that you will put in the cloud, not absolutely everything. So if you are worried about things that you aren't going to move to the cloud now, but you might move 5 years from now, don't do that. The clouds change very quickly. If something that you think you might want to put in the cloud in 5 years isn't supported today, there's a good chance it'll be supported in 5 years if it makes sense to be put in the cloud. Which means you really want to take a look at not only the capabilities that are there, but take a look at the services. What are the unique agile services that your business needs to achieve your business objectives? Who's got those services? Who's got them set up and ready and managed? Easy to integrate into your environment? Simple to plug in through RESTful APIs? And able to give you the most bang for the shortest amount of buck? That's our big recommendations here. I hope this gives you a good view of what's happening in the cloud space today. I think what we're going to do at this point is switch over to some questions and answers.
Thanks, James. So we've already gotten a few questions in from the audience. If anyone else has some questions that are top of mind, definitely feel free to submit those now. And we'll go ahead and jump in. So first question here from Mike is, just kind of any common challenges or pitfalls that you think folks should be aware of when they're first moving to the cloud?
Yeah, the most common pitfalls that we see are assumptions, incorrect assumptions about how the cloud it either must be or is just like my data center or just like my VMware environment. You wouldn't be choosing these environments if they were exactly the same. What would be the point? You want to go out to these other services because they give you something you couldn't get on your own. And that's usually the standardization, the automation that comes from them. So if you're expecting capabilities that you would use on-premise, but they don't actually make sense in the cloud, don't hold that against the cloud. Go in there and learn. Go in there and figure out what are these services that I can take advantage of. Another common pitfall is being concerned about lock-in. A lot of the cloud services that you will encounter on the large public clouds, they may have a unique name for that service, but they will use the same open web services, the same open source technologies that you will find on-premise and you will find on other clouds as well. That is not universally true. There are indeed unique services that we find on certain clouds. And in those cases, you do want to verify that it's going to give you an outsized gain. Lock-in is inevitable in anything. We've had it back in the Java era, WebSphere and WebLogic, you were locked in whichever choice you made. Oracle versus SQL Server, you were locked in whatever choice you made. They were, in all these cases, they were based on an open standard, they were based on open technologies, but you chose to use unique services or capabilities around that open source or that consistent model, standard model. So you have to have that mindset when you come in and start looking at these things.
Great, thank you. So next question in from Dale. What business planning elements are needed to move to the cloud? Does Forrester have assessments that track skills gaps, business process gaps, and are these important?
We do, absolutely. In the Forrester Cloud Playbook, which you can find on our homepage under the CIO, you will find business analysis tools here that help you plan out the skills in your organization. You will see benchmarks that give you comparisons to how other organizations are doing, so you can benchmark yourself as to whether you are a top 10% adopter, you're going to be a laggard. It helps you look at business planning processes as well, and it also helps you look at something we find problematic for a lot of companies, which is procurement. Procurement has a tendency to want to lock in long-term contracts, which don't go well with platforms that give you a pay-per-use advantage. You do want to make a decision about, do I want to be an Azure customer, do I want to be an AWS customer, but you don't want to lock in a term here where you're going to spend $100,000 every year with these guys if you're going to fluctuate your actual use. You want to have that flexibility there. So those are some of the skill sets you have to pay the most attention to.
Great, thank you. And seeing a few questions just around the presentation itself, so just want to note to everyone that we will be emailing all of you a recording of this presentation for your future reference. The next question in from Mary, can you expand on PCI compliance a bit? Can I assume that folks are considering storing credit card transactions in the cloud with encryption? That seems very risky.
Yeah, it's a good question, and yes, it is happening. We are seeing companies who are storing credit card information in the cloud, and they are encrypting this information, and it's not as scary as you think. In fact, if you look at the breaches that have occurred in the past year, Home Depot, Sony, Target, the list goes on and on, all these breaches occurred inside the data center of these organizations. One of the advantages you get in the cloud is that you are inside the security perimeter of the cloud provider, which means that they have significantly large and very skilled teams that are constantly monitoring the perimeter of the environment. Also, given that they build out the environment multi-tenant, they have built in some core security capabilities into that multi-tenancy, which makes it difficult for one tenant to intrude another tenant's storage, virtual machines, or other service capabilities that are there. Now, in the case of PCI, there are specific requirements that the cloud provider must go through in terms of the protection of the data and protection of the data center to ensure that no one can intrude in there, pull disks out, so forth. So I do encourage you that if you're going to use credit card information in the cloud, that you pick a cloud provider who has a PCI DSS certification against their environment. But obviously, there's a risk of somebody just not knowing what they're doing and screwing it up. And again, that falls more in the hands of the enterprise as a higher likelihood than the cloud provider. If the cloud provider were to allow a breach that occurred within a multi-tenant storage environment where someone ran amok across multiple tenancies, that'd probably be the end of that cloud provider entirely. And that's why they focus so much on ensuring that this environment is as closed down as possible. Now, up until last year, we also saw in many cases that some of the newer cloud services are out there. This was true of a lot of SaaS applications, particularly consumer class SaaS applications, did not do encryption at rest and did not do encryption in flight by default. For the most part, that is not the case anymore. In almost all these cases, you'll find that the default mode is encrypted from the beginning. And we're also now seeing that if you want to manage the keys, you just still aren't 100% sure you trust the cloud provider to protect this stuff. You want the encryption keys yourself. You can, of course, use an on-premise key management server. You can bring your own key management capability. But increasingly among the leading public clouds, and this became true this year with Azure, you now have a multi-tenant key management server available in the cloud that you can use to help with this process. So I wouldn't be too concerned about credit card information being stored in the cloud. I'd be more concerned about credit card information that's still sitting on people's tablets, sitting on people's laptops, still being written down and moved around inside a retail store. Those are the bigger breaches.
Great, thank you. I guess a follow-up question here from Richard. When you're talking about cloud providers, aren't you talking about Azure, or are you referring to co-location centers as well?
Well, no, we're talking about public cloud providers in this particular case, people that have the higher level services that they provide. Co-location, all you're really getting is a cage that you can put your own equipment into. They aren't typically providing application level services. They're not typically providing a managed hosting environment either. So in this particular case, we're talking about Microsoft Azure, AWS, Rackspace Cloud, Google Cloud, IBM BlueMix, and that class of capabilities.
Great. Thanks for the clarification. So it looks like we're getting a couple questions just around company size. I see one here where someone's asking about any specific guidance for mid-cap companies. So I guess just to elaborate on that a bit, do you have any perspective or guidance you'd share around how what you've talked about might vary between say a really large enterprise versus a smaller company?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And we do see big differences there, and it's mostly around the skill sets of the internal IT department. So we typically recommend for mid-sized firms, if you don't have a significant IT staff with deep technical skills, that you work with a managed service provider from the beginning in these environments. They typically have more experience in the cloud environment, understand what best practices are, and can help you be more productive faster in moving into these environments. Typically in the very large enterprise organizations, there's significant development teams with existing DevOps skills and IT resources that are in the business units that can be used to help make this happen. We even do see, though, in a lot of large enterprises, being large doesn't mean you got free resources. It just means you got a lot more people and they're overworked too. So managed services are very commonly being used in large enterprises as well. In the smaller organizations where we tend to see more going on their own, they typically don't have a large legacy of on-premise applications to worry about or migrate. They're typically building things anew and oftentimes very heavily based on SaaS already. In those cases, they might have the skill sets or bring the skills up sets on their own much, much quicker. So it just depends on what is the skill set within your team, what's the availability of that skill set, and what are the objectives you're trying to build. If you're building out mobile applications for the very first time, it helps to have somebody who's done it before.
Great. Well, thanks so much, James, for leading today's session. It looks like those are all the questions for today, so maybe we'll pause for a moment, see if anyone has any kind of final questions here. All right, looks like we're good to go. Thanks to everyone out in the audience for joining. If you want to join any future webinars, please be sure to check out the resource list. We've got some upcoming events link listed there. Thanks again, James, and hope you all have a good day.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Appreciate it.